You're listening to Math and Magic, a production of iHeartRadio.
When I interviewed Rupert Murdoch and did a 20,000-word profile of him in 95, we wound up spending probably 10 straight days in his office. I was a fly on the wall. We had dinner maybe six or seven of those nights. Yet he and I had a history. I had quit rather than work for him. So he knew I abhorred his journalism. And yet he was open in part, I think, because I said, look, I'm going to try and understand you. And I think that is seductive to people.
Hi, I'm Bob Pittman. Welcome to Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing, where we explore the entire gamut of marketing, from analytics to creative. On this episode, we have someone who has been exploring the same thing for most of his career. He's perhaps the greatest media critic and observer of my generation, Ken Auletta. Ken grew up in Coney Island, New York, worked for Robert Kennedy twice. He was a big part of the Village Voice and New York Magazine in their heydays, and for the last 25 years, he's written the Annals of Communications column for The New Yorker. His books have explored everything from the three broadcast networks before their fall from grace, to Google, to the advertising industry with his latest Frenemies. His interview was at the center of a recent documentary about the man behind McCarthyism and the blacklist of the 50s and a legendary New York fixer, Roy Cohn. He was a high school and college baseball player, and he continued that into a well-known writer's baseball team as an adult. He's a nice guy with a big smile who sometimes asks tough questions, and he's a friend. Welcome, Ken. Before we dig into the good stuff, I want to take a minute to start off with you in 60 seconds. Ready to go?
Fire away.
Do you prefer cats or dogs?
Dogs.
Brooklyn or Manhattan?
Brooklyn.
Beer or wine?
Wine.
Mets or Yankees?
Mets.
Do you prefer to play left field or first base?
I used to play left field, now first base, as you get older.
Cup or cone?
Cone.
Roller coasters or bumper cars?
Bumper cars.
Ted Turner or Barry Diller?
I like them both.
Cooking or tennis?
Cooking.
Okay, it's about to get harder. Secret talent?
Cooking.
Favorite Coney Island ride?
Oh boy. The horses at Steeplechase, which is no longer there.
Favorite sport?
Baseball, probably. I love the slowness and the art of good pitching.
Favorite meal to cook?
Red sauce.
What would you eat for your last meal?
Red sauce.
Smartest person you know?
John Malone.
Childhood hero?
Sandy Koufax.
First job?
Working for Howard Samuels, writing speeches and carrying coats.
Favorite book?
Crime and Punishment.
Quote to live by?
Albert Camus, a good hope is better than a bad holding.
Your proudest professional achievement?
Getting people who are hard to open up, to open up.
Scariest interview you've done?
Roy Cohn. He was easily the most disgusting human being I've ever met in my life. No one even close.
What did you want to be when you were growing up? Last question.
Baseball player.
Okay, this podcast is for entrepreneurs and marketers. So let me ask you the big question I'm sure they all want to know. You've met and interviewed the greats of media at their peak. Ted Turner, Larry Tisch, Rupert Murdoch, Barry Diller, and some not so greats like Harvey Weinstein. Is there something the successful ones have in common? Is there a secret sauce?
I don't know if this is a secret sauce, but there are certain commonalities. And one of them is a conviction that I'm going to do it my way. So it's a kind of self-confidence that people have. I know the answer to this, and I'm going to do it, and damn the torpedoes. Some of my staff think I'm crazy, and I'm going to go do it. And that's what Bill Gates did. That's what Barry Diller did on a number of occasions. That's what John Malone, that's what Rupert Murdoch did. And you don't necessarily agree with these people. I mean, I don't agree with Murdoch in terms of journalism, but as a businessman, he's not easily equaled.
Did you find these folks were, in addition to knowing exactly where they wanted to go, were they good listeners too?
Actually, that's a mixed bag. One of the things that make a good reporter is to be a good listener, and you got to draw people out. There are some, Rupert Murdoch, for instance, is a good listener. Bill Gates, when he ran Microsoft, was not a good listener. I think he is now in philanthropy. And if he were a good listener, he wouldn't have had the antitrust trial he had and have lost it.
Oh, we're going to come to that one.
Yeah. Barry Diller is a good listener. John Malone is a good listener. You have to be open to ideas and to exploring things. to come up with a big idea, a new idea, which many of these people did, they had to be listening to something.
As you began your exploration of your subjects, do your conversations usually confirm initial impressions, or are there surprises?
Always surprises. One of the things I say to people to try and seduce them to agree to a profile, and a profile is in the New Yorker, is a very elaborate process. It's probably 4 or 5 months of reporting. And you say to them, I want to be a fly on the wall in your office. I spend lots of time interviewing you. One of the things you say at the beginning is that my task is to understand you. So I'm starting with a clean slate. When I interviewed Murdoch and did a 20,000-word profile of him in 95, we wound up spending probably 10 straight days in his office. I was a fly on the wall. We had dinner maybe 6 or 7 of those nights. Yet he and I had a history. I had quit rather than work for him. So he knew I abhorred his journalism. And yet he was open in part, I think, because I said, look, I'm going to try and understand you. And I think that is seductive to people when you do that. But it's genuine. That's my task, to understand a person. And so you got to free yourself of preconceptions. Preconceptions that are facts. Murdoch doing lousy journalism is a fact. And ultimately, that came back and punched him in the nose when I wrote the profile.
I want to dig into a lot of those stories. But first, I'd like to get some context. So can we go back to your roots? You were born during World War II, grew up on Coney Island, Brooklyn. Your dad owned a sports equipment store. Can you paint the picture of those times?
My mother was Jewish. My father's Italian. Working class. I went to work in my father's sporting goods store when I was 9. My brother, who was 5 years older, worked there as well. 1 million people came off the subway in Coney Island every Saturday and Sunday in the summer. And they wanted something. They wanted hats. They wanted clogs or whatever. My father had a little sporting goods store right across from the train station. And he would open the outdoors and we would sell hats. We lived in a stoop house. You played Johnny on the Pony, Ringo Livio. And you played on the street. Everyone was on the street. There were no big apartment houses and projects then. So that's how I grew up. I went to public schools. At Abraham Lincoln High School, where I went, I had a 64 average and I was a screw up. I was thrown out of high school for stealing a pack of passes to get out of the building to hang out in the sweet shop. And my parents somehow got me a meeting with Abe Lass, who was the principal of Abraham Lincoln High School, a great man. And I came in with my T-shirt, and he says, tell me Kennett. And he deliberately used the word Kennett. And I hated being called Kennett. Tell me, Kennett, what do you like about Abraham Lincoln High School? And I said, baseball and football. He said, let me ask you a question, Kennett. He said, if you're not attending Abraham Lincoln High School, how are you going to play baseball and football for Abraham Lincoln? It never had dawned on me. I was a junior in high school, and he had my attention. And he said, here's the rules. And he became my lifelong mentor.
What was his punishment?
His punishment was I had no free periods. I had to come to his office, and I had to read books like Dickens and other great books.
Did this reading as punishment change your relationship?
Yeah, I became a more serious person. I got into the State University of Oswego and wound up going to graduate school.
You go off to college, and from what I've read, I can't tell if you were a serious activist or a hellraiser. You outed the president of the school for a shady real estate deal. He was eventually fired.
He was. Foster Brown was his name. I was a reporter for the paper and wrote a column, but I thought the paper was too tame, so I started an off-campus alternative newspaper called Pravda, which means truth in Russian. And this guy who helped me by distributing the mimeograph paper, his name was Dan Schaffman. And Dan was a communist, a self-proclaimed communist. I wasn't at all. But we were both trying to raise havoc. And one of the things I found out is that Foster Brown had these real estate deals. Someone must have given me a tip because I would not normally have gone to the land records. When I did go to land records, I found Foster Brown owned this land, which he was selling to the university and making a lot of money. And so at graduation, he was there, wouldn't shake my hand, but he was fired the next year.
Wow. What did college do to shape who you became?
I went there as a freshman, and we didn't stay in a dorm. We would stay in boarding houses off campus. We wheel our luggage off the train, and we go to this house, and these two elderly people say, hi, how are you? Mr. and Mrs. Gardner, you know, in Coney Island, you didn't say hello to strangers. I mean, you didn't, you always kept it a kind of a guarded distance. And I felt that all through college, that sense of community, that openness. And I always felt that I learned much more about that than I learned in subjects, in classes. I learned how to listen. I learned how to relate to people and talk to them and appreciate them. It was just a great experience.
Was this your first time really outside of Brooklyn?
Yeah. We couldn't take vacations because in the summer my dad had to work and we didn't have the money to go on vacation. So I'd never really been out of Coney Island.
You've been quoted as saying you think it was good for you to be a success at a school that was not as academically rigorous as a school where you would not have been the big success.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think I gained confidence by the fact that it was not as rigorous as, say, my graduate studies at Syracuse. I had no reason to be confident when I went to Oswego in my intellectual capacity. I remember being in a constitutional law class, and he said, I want you to pretend you're a Supreme Court justice and take the opposite position from the one you believe in. So in my case, it was defend states' rights against civil rights. I found it so stimulating to do that. I suddenly felt like, oh my God, I can hold my own. I can stand up. You got confidence at a place like Oswego, and I feel eternally grateful.
You went off to grad school at Syracuse. You joined the Air Force Reserves. You did 6 months active duty during the Vietnam War.
Right.
You came out of all this working for a candidate for the governor of New York. You worked for Bobby Kennedy twice. But after his assassination, you left politics and moved to media. What happened to you?
I always wanted to be in journalism. I was in a PhD program. I got a master's degree, went a little beyond that, but then said it's boring. Got a job with this guy, Howard Samuels, this wonderful man. It was called the Upstate Industrialist. He started a company called Cordite, very successful. But he went to run for governor, and I was a writer and wrote for the column at the school paper. The dean of the Maxwell School recommended me to him as a speechwriter. He ran for governor, lost. But after Bobby Kennedy died in 68, I said, well, now this is an opportunity to go do journalism again. So we started a weekly newspaper called the Manhattan Tribune. It was supposed to be a black-white newspaper. It was a black editor and a white editor, me. And it was a wonderful experience, but the guy who put up the money, Bill Haddad, had a business, and when Nixon was elected, he wanted us to write nice things about Nixon, so me and my co-editor and a number of other people just quit.
You have one detour. You were the executive director of the New York City Off-Track Betting Corporation.
I had a big job there as executive director. In 69, Howard Samuels, the guy I worked for and was very loyal to and deeply fond of, he was the first Democrat to endorse John Lindsay for re-election as an independent in 1969. And Lindsay came and said, New York has started the first off-track betting corporation in the country. Howard, would you and your businessman, would you run it? So Howard started it. I was his executive director in the office next door to him for about 3 years. And then I left to plot his campaign for governor in 74. He was the heavy favorite to win. He was called Howie the Horse, and he was very well known. And I was a campaign manager. And with my help, he went from a 20-point lead to a 20-point defeat. And that was the end of my politics.
Any insights from your experience in all of that, politics, running off-track betting, that you've applied today?
Well, one of the truisms that punches me in the nose all the time as a journalist, and one of the reasons why I think when you do profiles of people, you really got to be in their office and you got to dig deep, is what I call the human factor. Oftentimes, you'll find the most mathematically, scientifically oriented person making seat-of-the-pants decisions for very human reasons. For instance, I'm doing a profile of John Malone in 1994. He was then the most powerful person in television. John Malone didn't have a television in his office, and the phones rarely rang. But at 12 o'clock as I'm sitting there, I hear a phone ring, and he opens up a drawer, and he texts out a red phone. Yes, dear, I'll be right there, dear. At 5 o'clock, same thing happens. Yes, dear, I'll be right there. So this happens 2 days in a row, and I said, all right, Malone, what is that all about? He said, that's my wife. I meet her at the gym and I meet her for lunch every day. I said, so let me ask you a question. You just sold your company to the telephone company, TCI, $34 billion. You made a lot of money. He said, yeah, it was good. I said, was that the only reason you sold your company? And he said, actually, it wasn't. I said, what was the other reason? The other reason I did it, was a very human reason. My wife. I said, what do you mean? He said she would leave me if I didn't have a more normal life. You, darling, promised me when you married me, you would be there, but you're never there. You're always working. I need you there more. I mean, take Bill Gates. When I covered Microsoft antitrust trial, Bill Gates could have avoided that entire trial, could have avoided the charges from the Justice Department, who's a monopoly, had he just acknowledged, yes, we have a large footprint, and I'm not going to answer David Boies's questions like a brig. I'm not going to be an arrogant guy. I'm going to be humble. When I interviewed the judge in that trial, he said he didn't believe Bill Gates because he watched the deposition. So if Bill Gates had not been so proud, so arrogant at that point in time, he could have avoided a lot of headache. Again, human factor.
Just hold on a second because we've got so much more to talk about. We'll be back after a quick break. Welcome back to Math and Magic. We're here with Ken Auletta.
You went on to stardom at the Village Voice, New York Magazine. You wrote and won one of your first awards for an article called 50 Bad Decisions That Brought About the New York Fiscal Crisis. Did that make you an insider suddenly to this kind of community, or were you a threat to them?
I was a threat to them. The Voice was a threat to the establishment. And I was writing, actually, I would argue, a piece that had more impact was a piece I wrote for the New York Magazine, a cover story, Should These People Go to Jail? And it looked at the decisions that were made over the years that put the city in this fiscal hole by bankers, by union leaders, by mayors, by governors, and looked at the law and said, did they commit fraud? Did they lie to the public and say they had money they didn't really have? And I'll never forget that piece because I wrote it in an almost scholarly way. I did a lot of reporting and said, one hand, the other hand, blah, blah, blah. Milton Glaser, who was one of the most geniuses I've ever met, Clay Felker was the editor, and Milton was there, and Walter Bernard, who was his deputy. And I said, you know, the story is these people commit a crime, and, you know, it's complicated. And Milton said, how about this? Took out a pad, and he drew prison bars, and he had, holding the prison bars, Mayor Beam, Mayor Lindsay, Governor Rockefeller, Walter Wriston, the head of Citibank. And he said, how about this as a headline? Should these people go to jail? And I said, oh my God, it was just brilliant. You know, that gets people to read a piece.
New York Magazine was the hot of the moment media property. It was sort of the Facebook of its day. Its founder, Clay Felker, who you mentioned, could not have been more important. And then Rupert Murdoch, still at the beginning of his empire, takes it over. You walked out with a bunch of people.
What happened was Rupert Murdoch is a bold businessman who takes risks, but he also cuts corners. He and Clay Felker were friends. Clay Felker introduced him to Dorothy Schiff in 1975. He bought the New York Post and promised to keep it a liberal newspaper, and of course immediately made it a conservative newspaper. Then in 1976, Clay Felker confided in his friend Rupert Murdoch. He said, I'm having terrible problems with my board of directors, and it's just awful. I got to figure out something. Murdoch then went behind Felker's back, went to the board of directors, and made a deal to buy the company out from his friend, Clay Felker. So when we heard that, and when that became public, all of us, almost the entire staff, went on strike. We said, we're not going to work for Rupert Murdoch. I was in my late 20s. I knew Howard Squadron, who was Rupert Murdoch's attorney, because he had helped Howard Samuels when I was in politics. We go to Howard's office, and I say, Howard, I just want to tell you, Murdoch should back away and not do this takeover, because all of us are going to leave. We're not going to work for Rupert Murdoch. And that'll be a disaster for New York Magazine. And Howard looked at me and he said, Ken, I don't think you understand. I said, what? He said, your furniture, you can be replaced. And that's what happened. We all quit and he replaced us all with furniture. So it's a lesson that money talks.
If you had the perspective of you today, would you have done it then?
Absolutely. I was glad I did it. I must say, in fairness, we worried that Murdoch would take New York Magazine down market the way he took the New York Post. And he didn't do that. And by the way, I was the only one who also worked at the Village Voice then. So I was quitting both. He didn't do that to the Voice. In fact, one of Murdoch's great frustrations is he could not control the Village Voice. And he didn't try to control New York Magazine because it was successful the way it was. Why mess with that? But on balance, I'm happy I took the position. And I think most of us would say the same thing.
It worked out well for you.
Yeah, it worked out well. But it was actually interesting what happened. I remember figuring out, what am I going to do now? And I go out to lunch with Richard Reeves, who was my buddy. We come back to my apartment, and there's a message on the machine. I just pressed the button, and it said, "Hello, Mr. Auletta. This is William Shawn, S-H-A-W-N. He spelled his name. And he was the editor of The New Yorker.
Of course.
Call me, and that's how I started at The New Yorker. I wound up doing longer pieces for The New Yorker, got a column in the New York Daily News on Sundays, and did a weekly television show on WNET. So my life turned out okay.
Let's get into some insights. You are, through your work, an expert on disruption and transformation, or lack of it, in the media and tech world. You covered the Microsoft trial. We talked about it 20 years ago. What came out of that trial that's relevant today with all the talk that's going on about tech and the tech giants?
Microsoft lost the trial both in Judge Jackson's federal district court and in the Court of Appeals. They were deemed to be a monopoly. But the appeals court overruled Judge Jackson's ruling that they should be broken up. In any case, Microsoft, because it was left in such bad odor by that decision and by its own behavior in that trial, they really suffered a serious blow. Less ability to recruit good people who didn't want to work for an ogre. They became a much more tentative company. And the lesson for that, as you spin forward, you see today a much greater bipartisan support for regulating the Facebooks and the Googles and the Amazons. And they are just as arrogant and as out of touch with Washington. Those politicians have real power. Now, when you watch Mark Zuckerberg be interviewed by the Senate, and you see these unbelievably dumb questions that senators ask, you're almost sympathetic to Mark Zuckerberg because of that. On the other hand, they are in danger today of being regulated because people are worried about not just their influence and power over journalism, over privacy, just too much power. The lesson for them is heed what happened to Microsoft. Even though Microsoft was not broken up, they suffered.
Do you think the government can understand the issues well enough to effectively regulate the tech giants, or do they not quite know what they're looking at?
I think they don't quite know what they're looking at. I mean, when you see Senator Orrin Hatch ask Mark Zuckerberg, "So you're free, how do you make your money?" I mean, God, you just say, "Oh my God, I can't believe this guy." I remember when the government recommended to break up Microsoft, and the judge, who was a wonderful man but digitally illiterate, I thought it was so foolish, so unbelievably foolish, that if you were conversant with the way the world was moving, open source, the internet, packet software was Microsoft was dead at some point. Don't artificially manufacture a
solution. What do you think the remedy should have been?
Well, in part, the remedy was scold them, humiliate them, shame them. That's something I believe in. It's a fundamental point that you have to shame people. Journalism has a big role in that, to expose wrongdoing, expose arrogance, expose stupidity or corruption. You take Mark Zuckerberg today or Sheryl Sandberg today. I've spent time with both of them over the years and written profile of her and quite admire her. But they've been shamed. That affects their behavior and will affect their behavior, perhaps more than a misguided government regulation would. By the way, same is true for journalism. One of the most fun pieces I ever did for The New Yorker was, I think, in 94. It was called FEE Speech. I interviewed about 50 journalists about the fees they took to give speeches from organizations that they wrote about. And I'll never forget that. People I admired telling me, "I don't have to answer that question. It's private." I said, "What do you mean it's private? Would you let a politician get away with that answer?"
Were you shunned for that?
Yeah, I was. Oh, it made a lot of people really angry. But that was fun. I mean, but it also has an effect. I mean, I know organizations that literally institute a policy saying you have to come to us for approval before you give a paid speech, or you can't give paid speeches to organizations you write about or cover. And I think that's great.
Let's fast forward 20 years. You wrote about the disruption of the ad business with Frenemies and Google before that. How are those two interconnected?
Google started out when they formed in 1998. They didn't have any idea how to make money. By the way, Facebook was the same some years later. But what happened was in 2004, Google was trying to figure out how do we make money? And they came up with both AdSense and AdWords. Today, 92% of Google's revenues come from advertising, which is why it's free. 98% of Facebook's comes from advertising. They originally were very reluctant to do advertising. They felt it would cheapen the product, and they don't have that compunction today.
When we look at the two, though, with the advertising industry and Google, is the advertising business now controlled by Google and Facebook?
It's certainly dominated by them. I mean, more than 50% of digital ads go to those two companies, and 75% of the growth in digital advertising goes to those two companies. The one to watch out for is Amazon. Amazon is growing like a rocket, faster. And the reason for that is that they have the most vital information an advertiser wants. You know this better than I do.
Purchase decision. So do you think that Google and Facebook and Amazon pushing the advertising business to data is making the advertising business ultimately stronger?
Well, it does in some ways, but it also becomes a menace to the advertising business because advertising business wants more data, and yet more data means less privacy. The privacy issue has really surfaced and risen as a major concern, and you watch a company like Apple make the opposite argument, saying, don't go to Google and Facebook and Amazon. We won't violate your privacy, and they do. And so that becomes a defining difference between some of the digital companies as well.
You look at new leaders in the advertising business. I look at Christian Jewell, Scott Hagedorn, people who are really digitally savvy and see the world through the lens of data. Is that driven by this disruption that's come from these original tech players?
A basic division is between math men and mad men. The math men are the digitally savvy people who want data, more and more data, and they say we can create algorithms to target ads at people knowing enough about those people that they'll be interested in our product. And the creativity matters less, the instinct, the judgment matters less. It's a math problem. And that's a division in the ad world that will persist, I think.
In Three Blind Mice, a while back, you called the demise of the broadcast TV networks. Looking back, was there anything you missed or did it play out as you expected?
It didn't play out totally as I expected. What I said in Three Blind Mice is that the broadcast television networks were being disrupted by a new technology, cable.
We were new tech in the cable days.
And you were, and you had two sources of revenue, advertising, but you also had subscriptions. Broadcast was all advertising. So I said, broadcasting is in trouble unless they can get another source of revenue. What happened was, and actually Congress played the largest role in this, they passed the Cable Act in 94. Cable Act allowed retransmission consent, so the cable companies were required to pay the broadcast networks for use of their programs. The second thing was the FinCEN rules were changed, which allowed the networks now to own the programs and syndicate them, and therefore creating another source of revenue for them. Particularly when the digital world came on, the Netflixes and the YouTubes, it allowed them to sell programmings to them. CBS went from almost 100% reliant on revenues from advertising to 50% reliant on advertising. They were selling programs to Netflix and to stations. They were getting retransmission consent, a couple of $1 billion from cable. And they were selling overseas the programs that they own now. And that's true of all the networks. But then the question becomes, by selling their programs to Netflix, was CBS and Fox and NBC building up a competitor? And I think they are.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thinking about what they could have done differently, the cable companies, John Malone, et cetera, start building out the major cities. They need something more than distant TV signals. They need real cable networks. They first go to ABC, NBC, CBS and say, hey, I've had this idea. Why don't you build us these networks? The broadcast networks basically say, go away. What, are you crazy? Why would we cannibalize ourselves? Let's contrast this to Steve Jobs. He saved Apple, transformed it, came out with this great new thing called the iPod, and he had iTunes. And then it was going to be apparent music was going to be on the phones. So what does he do? He goes into the phone business, basically cannibalizes himself, but I don't think there's a person alive looking at that that would say that turned out to be the wrong move. What was different about those two and how they looked at it?
I think Steve Jobs was not wedded to the past in any way. And by the way, he was not an employee who worried about his stock price, which most of the network people, they were not owners. They were employees. They were managers. And he thought out of the box. An example of a traditional media person who thought outside the box is Bob Iger. The deals he made with Steve Jobs. I mean, Michael Eisner would not make those deals.
Right.
Bob Iger becomes CEO, and suddenly he's reaching out. His people are saying, what are you reaching out to him? He's the enemy. He's competing with our animation business. He's, no, no, I want to own that animation business. I wanted to transform Disney's animation business.
I watched the Roy Cohn documentary. Your interview was the thread. Roy Cohn, for people who don't remember, is the sidekick of Joe McCarthy. He was the fixer in New York. He sort of knew everybody and sort of got stuff done in probably not the most scrupulous ways. And you said you felt a little creepy doing that interview. What did you learn about our city and about politics and about the way things are done through that interview?
He had enormous political power. First interview we did was at lunch at the 21 Club where he had a choice table. And I'm sitting there. He didn't order, and I ordered a hamburger and french fries. And he's sitting next to me, side by side, with his fingers, he's taking french fries off my plate and eating them. And I'm kind of stunned by it. And he's looking around the room, and he sees his former clients, Bess Myers and other people, people who hired him to kill their spouse or their business partner. And you realize the source of his power was that people hired him to kill for them, legally. And so I write this piece, and I thought he would hate it. It was called The Legal Executioner on the cover. And it was tough on him. And he calls me up, and I said, oh, God, I'm going to get yelled at by this creep. And he says, Ken, I loved your piece. How did we get 500 copies? And I realized what pleased him, it was a calling card. He said, would you sign one? And I signed it, and I said, to Roy Cohn, who I wished I had punched. And then he started attacking me after that.
From your vantage point and with the keen pattern recognition you have, for a CEO listening to this or an entrepreneur, what advice would you give them about success and failure?
Be a good listener. Both Barry Diller and Bob Iger, when they were trying to understand the digital world, Barry Diller said, I don't do emails. I do them just twice a day so I can concentrate. But Bob Iger said to me he spent an hour a day just surfing the web, just trying to understand what was going on in the sites. So I think listening, being open, asking questions is critical. I think humility is critical. Iger, in his book, talks about how you got to make people feel good. And I'll never forget when I was doing my Three Blind Mice book on television networks, one of the great managers was Dan Burke of Cap City. I would spend time with him. Dan would go around and he would compliment people. And I said to him at one point, why do you compliment people all the time? And he looked at me, he said, Ken, have you ever met anyone who tires of a compliment? And that was one of his reasons for success. I mean, he made people feel good.
I want to get one more personal insight. Your wife, Binky, is a hugely successful literary agent. How is living in a household with your careers intertwined? Upsides and downsides.
Well, the upside is you have so much to talk about. You're in kindred fields. You got to read Jenny Egan, who she represents. And I read Jenny Egan. I said, wow. And so that's great. The downside is that Binky is the first person who edits my work, and she kills me.
So as we wrap up, we always end where we began, math and magic. Let's give a shout out to those you think deserve it. Who's the best analytical business, marketing, or media person? The math side of it.
Irwin Gottlieb.
Best magician, the showman or showwoman.
Michael Kessin's pretty good.
Ken, your insights have shaped a generation. Your contributions to Penn, the Public Library, New York Shakespeare Festival, which is now Public Theater, and more are greatly appreciated too. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Bob. Enjoyed it.
Here are a few things I picked up in my conversation with Ken. One, to really understand someone, you have to start with a clean slate. By freeing himself of preconceptions, Ken was able to earn the trust of people he had had a history with, like Rupert Murdoch, and ultimately get them to agree to a profile. Two, be a good listener. Whether you're a CEO or a journalist, asking questions is key to understanding the world around you. 3, stand up for what you believe in. When Ken walked out of his job at New York Magazine on principle, he quickly got a call from The New Yorker that would change his career trajectory. Thanks for listening. I'm Bob Pittman.
That's it for today's episode. Thanks so much for listening to Math and Magic, a production of iHeartRadio. The show is hosted by Bob Pittman. Special thanks to Sue Schillinger for booking and wrangling our wonderful talent, which is no small feat. Nikki Etor for pulling research, Bill Plax and Michael Azar for their recording help, our editor Ryan Murdoch, and of course, Gail, Raul, Eric, Angel, Noel, Mango, and everyone who helped bring this show to your ears. Until next time.